KZSU-FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, as well as an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today, we're going to be turning back towards issues involving privacy and anonymity in technology and in internet communications in particular. Over the last year plus, more recently, I've had on several guests discussing issues of privacy, including Dan Soliv, and Jonathan Zittrain, and various other guests who have been focusing in one way or another on how we deal with privacy issues in technology. And today I'm very excited to have on two people involved in a primary project and really an application and a service that goes directly to the heart of internet communications, how we communicate on the internet generally, what our identity is in technology, and what information, in fact, can be adduced from us by using the technology. The project is the Tor Project, and the guests are Andrew Luman and Wendy Seltzer. Andrew is the executive director of Tor, and Wendy Seltzer is a professor at American University visiting, also a fellow at the Berkman Center at Harvard College, and also, lastly, is on the board of directors of Tor. Tor is a project that is designed, and of course, Wendy and Andrew will explain it in more detail, designed to allow individuals to communicate using the internet in ways that protect their anonymity and protect their privacy. And this, of course, is an important issue. It's an important issue for a variety of reasons. Anyone that uses technology runs the risk that information that they would otherwise not want to be made public could be made public, or certainly used in ways that they would not want. And so consumers, for example, are quite concerned and should be quite concerned about what information is floating out there when they do a Google search or when they purchase an item online and so forth. But this Tor project goes well beyond that, and the list of entities and individuals that use Tor is quite interesting and quite broad, because not only could it be used by any internet user, but more specifically, it has been used by intelligence gathering entities, organizations dealing with human rights issues, individuals that are whistleblowers or considering being whistleblowers on their in their companies or regarding their employers, as well as some more disturbing uses, which are also, again, go to the issue of people using technology in ways to maintain their anonymity. Tor is designed to allow that behavior, and what we're going to be discussing today is not only the technical side of Tor, but also some of its ramifications. And in the process, we'll be discussing policy involving privacy and anonymous communication online. So I'm very excited to have both Andrew Luman and Wendy Seltzer on the show today, and I thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Welcome. Let's start off, and I always ask my guests this first initial question. Your background, so how did you get involved in these issues, and how did you wind up focusing on these issues? So, Andrew, we'll start with you.
Sure. So I got involved in the late 90s when I was working for a company that would send me over to Asia and to various countries where they would, you know, censor their information by state government. And I happened to put in a VPN for the company, and I noticed all the employees were staying late at night, just searching the internet, you know, reading all the news sites to counter what the government was telling them. And that was really the first key that, you know, hey, free access to information and open, unfiltered internet is a very good thing, because at least lets the people decide what they want to view or believe, and they can make their own decisions.
And Wendy?
It's been from there over the past, you know, 6 years I've been working with Tor, that, you know, Tor is a fine solution, and the belief of open and free access to information is a powerful thing that more of the world should have.
Wendy?
I come to these questions as a lawyer motivated by the power of the First Amendment and the power of communications technologies to enhance the First Amendment, freedom of speech, freedom to receive information and to share information. And one of the things that accompanies that freedom of speech in the First Amendment is the freedom to speak anonymously and to receive information anonymously, to speak up as part of a minority without the fear of discrimination, and to participate in conversations without being tracked and identified all the time. Now, through subtle changes in technology, when you go online, you are more often automatically identified, whether you want to be or not. So in order to reclaim some of the freedom of speech that the technology gives to us, we also need to provide people the tools for anonymity. So when I saw the Tor Project working on that, it was very interesting to me as sort of part of the technological complement to the legal protections.
Your backgrounds are both interesting, and I think it's part of the discussion. So how does your background bring you to these topics, and what are your particular interests within the world of privacy and anonymity on the Internet?
Well, my background is technology. I have been involved in development and systems engineering for longer than I want to admit to. The power to, I guess, surveil and find out what people are doing and how they're doing without them really knowing it is something I've actually helped build these systems, you know, advertising networks in the past. And at some point, you begin to realize that, you know, it's just how you protect yourself. The bar moves so far to one side that you can't, typical internet user can't figure out that, you know, the typical internet user doesn't even realize what's being recorded about them. Privacy policies stated on websites list a number of things, none of which actually tells you what they do with the information. Very few people say, here's all the information we collect, and here's what we do with it. It's all buried in dense legalese, because if people actually understood what was being recorded and the patterns being built up over time, they would most likely start to freak out. Same with advertising networks, same with your own ISP, which in a free country, you know, these are market economies, these are all fine things these companies can do, but it would be great to have the counterbalance to you should control what information you give out, not give it out by default. In closed societies, the same amount of information is available, and when you do such things online, if you cross some sort of government filter or censorship, then you could have very real consequences for your actions, whether innocently or otherwise.
Wendy?
Then my background, it comes from a mix of law, political theory, and a general interest in technology and the ways that we can use technology to achieve a better society, if you will. The internet and powerful computers put lots more of these tools into individual hands, but if we want to assure a true marketplace of ideas, we also need to make sure that there's a climate in which individuals can express themselves safe from retribution, can gain access to the expressions of others, even from countries where they may be behind national firewalls or restrictive filtering regimes where they're denied access to those ideas. And I think there's tremendous power in the exchange of information, and so it's really excited me to see Tor used as a tool for exchange of information and ideas.
Let's talk about Tor in particular, and I guess really the top-level question, Andrew. Aside from what is Tor, I think for listeners that are not familiar with the nuts and bolts of how information is communicated technically through the Internet, I'll ask you the question, what is Tor, and how does Internet communication work in sum?
So Tor is a tool that helps you defeat traffic analysis. Traffic analysis is what you do when you want to figure out who's talking to who. Consider it sort of social network. It's not so, it's who you talk to, what, how much you say, and when you say it is traffic analysis. On the internet, you know, you connect to your computer, you go through your ISP, your cable modem, or dial-up, or DSL, or whatever you have. Your ISP can watch all of your traffic. They can see what sites you visit. They can see how often you visit them. They can see how much data you send or receive. When they have an ISP, so you go all the way up through ISPs around the country, and you can start to see things in aggregate where, you know, the big backbone ISPs like an AT&T or Verizon, which is also MCI, Quest, all of these, and globally, they can see, you know, all the traffic coming from ISPs going to different ISPs. For instance, if you're, you know, a cancer survivor, you want to go research whatever, say it's breast cancer, your ISP can see you put in the search terms to Google breast cancer. They can see you went to Google. They can see how long you spent looking for it and how much you downloaded. What Tor helps you do is Tor takes your traffic, you download our software, you put it on your laptop or desktop or whatever, and it connects you to a global network of relays so that your traffic becomes encrypted, leaves your computer encrypted, heads off to a relay, which then re-encrypts it, sends it off to a second relay, which then re-encrypts it, sends it off to a third relay, which then decrypts it and sends your original traffic out. So much like a tunnel, what you send into the tunnel is what comes out in the end. Someone watching your traffic, all they will see is that they're seeing encrypted traffic that goes to a bunch of random IP addresses around the world. In the case of your ISP, they can only watch locally, so all they'll see is, you know, like SSL encrypted traffic go from your computer to somewhere in the world. What we don't defend against is called the global passive adversary, which is someone who can watch all the internet traffic in the world. There are intelligence agencies that is believed to have the ability to do this, where they can watch, you know, your traffic leaves, say, Boston, Mass., and then it goes out to France, and it goes out to Japan, and then it exits in, I don't know, Argentina. Someone who can do that, you know, Tor will protect you somewhat, but in the end, you know, if your adversary or the person you're trying to protect your traffic from is that big and powerful, Tor is not the only tool you need. You need far more operational information security than Tor is going to provide. But that being said, those agencies are few and far between, and if you're already on their radar that much that they're going to spend that many resources, you've already probably done far greater number of incidents to get you on that sort of watch list. For the general internet user, you know, if I want to go shopping at, say, Amazon.com, and I don't want them to necessarily know who I am or where I am until I'm ready to divulge that info, I'll use Tor. You know, my ISP won't know where I'm browsing. Someone watching, you know, if I'm an open wireless at a coffee shop, someone can't see where I'm traveling, what I'm doing, how long I'm looking at websites. And then it's up to me to control the conversation as to if I'm ready to go buy something, I can either do it over Tor, but at that point, that will de-anonymize myself since I have to give Amazon an address and a credit card info and stuff like that. Or I can switch off Tor and say, all right, I'm going to go to Amazon directly and purchase my items. And Amazon won't have any idea that this person who was browsing from Argentina was looking at, you know, whatever, backpacks. They would be able to tie the traffic streams together to me. So just see, you know, this guy Andrew comes in, all of a sudden he comes out of Boston, he buys a backpack, and he must have known what he wanted. And obviously, there's a whole bunch of data I gave them, the fact that I wanted a backpack, that I came from Boston, you know, the type of browser and operating system I use. But they don't have a whole history of me trying to find what I'm doing, what I wanted to buy, and what else I looked at.
And Andrew, when we think about these issues,
started a program of price discrimination, where if they thought you were somebody who was willing to pay a little bit more for an item, they'd charge you a little bit more. And they determined who was willing to pay a little bit more by whom they'd seen on the site previously. So if you were a good, loyal customer of Amazon, you'd be one price for your books, and that would be a higher price than the newcomer would see. They killed that program pretty quickly after the backlash, but if other merchants try similar things, why should they know who you are until you are ready to tell them? And why shouldn't you be able to see how their store looks to the anonymous person walking by, rather than having to identify yourself at the gate? And so that's one of the things that Tor can do for you, let you see what this website looks like to anybody else, rather than to you as specifically identified from your past history.
You know, it's an interesting point that you raise with regard to retail distribution, because, of course, the flip side of it is maybe you want to be tracked. But then, of course, then the answer is, well, then don't use Tor. But it raises and I want to go back to Andrew for a moment before Wendy, we discuss some of the policy issues and just talk a little bit more about the basic structure of Tor. Andrew, you mentioned relays, which I guess leads to a follow-up question of what is onion routing and what is a Tor server, and who or what entities are Tor servers?
So, onion routing is a protocol developed by the NEMA Research Labs in the 1990s. They open sourced it and unencumbered it as public domain software. And Roger Dingledine was a grad student at MIT, and he took the onion routing protocol and applied it to the internet, which is, you know, generally termed as the second generation onion routing. The name Tor came from people would frequently ask, well, which onion router are you working on? And that's, you know, we call it the onion router. It started off as TOR as an acronym, but now it's just Tor, just to distinguish us from, you know, we are the Tor network, the Tor software, not, quote, the onion router anymore. The software is something you download and put on your machine, whether it's Windows, Macintosh, Linux. There's software for iPhones and Android as well. It's in development. The onion router, the way it basically works is layers of encryption. You think of layers of an onion, you have your client puts the first layer of encryption on your traffic, the next router, the next relay you talk to, which is really a proxy, puts another layer of encryption on, you talk to the second one, it strips off a layer, it puts on a layer, you have a third layer, and then it, you know, it, so everything's double encrypted, triple encrypted by the time you get to your exit. And then your traffic is then stripped of encryption and sent off as it is natively. So, if you want to talk to, like, Craigslist, which is an unencrypted website, your client encrypts it. It's encrypted through the network until the last exit, which we call an exit relay. That will strip off the encryption and send out your original request to Craigslist. If you're talking to, like, your banking site, which is already encrypted, so you add more, you still get all the benefits of encryption through the Tor network, but the exit relay will strip off the last layer of encryption, and since your original request was encrypted to your banking site, that gets passed on untouched to your banking site. So it's what you put into it comes out of it, and this is true for web browsing, IM, you know, instant messaging clients. People use all sorts of, you know, social networking technologies over Tor. We because they don't want their local people, whether they're on an open wireless, an internet cafe, or a coffee shop or whatever, they don't want people seeing what they're doing. Even if they're not doing anything, you know, quote, suspicious, just the fact that, you know, they don't want to see, you know, I'm going to Facebook and I'm updating my things, saying, hey, I'm in a coffee shop. there are, so the relays are run by volunteers. We have around 1,500 of them spread across the world. And these are people who donate their computer to run a Tor relay. And the software you download can be both a client and a relay. There is no special different set of software. We have a GUI, a graphical window, that you can configure a Tor with to say, you know, here's what I want to do with it, or I want to be a client, or my firewall restricts me, all these other technologies. And the other option is you can say, I want to share my bandwidth. And you can set up relaying so that others can transit traffic through you and off to other relays or off to their final destination website. The interesting piece of this is Tor is a nonprofit company, and we don't track who downloads the software. We don't track who runs the software. What we do is, as a client, you don't trust the network. The network is run by, like I said, 1,500 volunteers. You don't have to trust any of them as using the Tor client. The Tor client picks its own path to the network. So that way, protects you from someone setting up, say, some jerk setting up a relay saying, I'm going to redirect all this stuff to my ad-laden website and force all your traffic to there. Or I want to snoop on all these people, so I'm going to set up three relays, and I'm going to have your traffic all get shoved through my three relays so I can see where you're browsing and what you're doing. That doesn't happen because the Tor client picks its path to the network. And the way we do this is the Tor network creates a consensus of, there are seven or eight directory authorities, which are run by trusted individuals. And what they simply do is say, here's all the relays I've heard about. They talk to the other seven and basically ask, have you heard about these relays? Do you agree that this is the relay, this is the IP, this is what the bandwidth they're providing, you know, these sort of parameters? All the seven directory authorities agreed with each other and produce what's called a consensus. And the consensus is what your client trusts. As in, seven different organizations have said, this is good. And now I'm going to pick up. Now I have a picture of the whole network. I'm going to send a path through it. While this sounds probably more complex than it needs to be, the other benefit of this is there is no one organization to find out all your traffic. If you are using Tor because you are a whistleblower at some large company doing very bad things in some country, you're. Employer that you just blew the whistle on can't go to a company and say, I want all the traffic for this user for this timestamp. Because what they'd have to do is our answer as a Tor project would be, well, we don't have any of those records. We don't have any way to record those records. And here's 1,500 users you can go contact in, you know, 100 different countries and try to get them to give up their logs. The flip side of this is there is no logs. We don't record traffic on any relay by default. Someone very sophisticated would have to know how to change the software to record traffic that goes through it. And while that's a possibility, they still don't. All they'll see is their individual piece, as in no node or no relay knows the entire request from start to finish. So all they'll see is traffic came in from this relay. It went out to that relay. Or at worst, traffic came in from this IP address and went out to, you know, this website. But again, the IP address will be a relay. No one will have any idea of the whole picture of what you're doing.
We're talking to Andrew Lumen and Wendy Seltzer regarding the Tor project.
Around the world, regardless of the censorship regimes, and why we help, you know, you don't have to trust us as an organization. You don't have to trust me personally. You know, you can read the code. If you don't understand the code, you can have someone read through it and tell you what's good, tell you what's bad. and you can make your own decisions. The idea is to put the power in the hands of the user, not in the organization. And, you know, the quote, trust us, business method.
We are talking with...
And the two details.
This is no. It's good to have the details, because I think, frankly, as we think about internet technology, there's a basic question of how all of this works, and so how anonymity is protected through the use of Tor, I think, is an important thing to understand. We are talking to Andrew Lumen and Wendy Seltzer of the Tor Project on KZSU FM Stanford's Hearsay Culture. Hearsay Culture, for those of you that listen regularly, you know that KZSU is, and in fact, Hearsay Culture is, a nonprofit and non-commercial service, and KZSU is a nonprofit non-commercial radio station located at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. If you are interested in making a donation to KZSU, you have a couple of options. You can go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Alternatively, you can go to internet communication. You can use Tor if you choose, but you'll want to email underwriting at kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting at kzsu.stanford.edu. And hopefully, one way or another, if you're interested in making a donation, going those routes, you will get a response. So regardless, I do hope that you continue to listen to KZSU, but I do urge you to consider making a donation to the station. Wendy, let's talk a little bit, before we get into policy, let's talk a little bit about the history of Tor, because Tor previously has been affiliated with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, but it's unusual to say that Tor, while having that affiliation with EFF, also, as was mentioned by Andrew briefly, has its derivation and its initial upbringing from the military. And we don't see a lot of organizations that can say that they have connections to both the military as well as EFF. So perhaps you could give us a little bit of a sense of the history of Tor.
Well, yes, you're right, and Roger likes to say that Tor is about the only organization that can say it's received funding from both EFF and the military. And that recognizes the diversity of uses to which the technology is relevant. The military, when conducting surveillance or investigations, doesn't want everyone to be able to pinpoint that traffic back to it, and whistleblowers and civil libertarians, when speaking online, want to be able to do so without leaving trails everywhere. So anonymity has many uses, and as mentioned earlier, or as Andrew mentioned, the initial technological design came out of the Naval Research Labs, and from there, Roger Dingeldine began work on programming to make this more a general technology and useful to more people, and the project has grown since then as more people showed an interest in using the technology, and more security researchers looked into its anonymity properties. Another unique feature of Tor, or an important feature of Tor, is that it's completely open. Its source code is open and freely licensed under a BSD copyright license, allowing anyone to use and modify it. Its specification is open. Its design is transparent. And so, as Andrew said, that means we don't have to say, trust us. You can read the code yourself, or you can ask someone else you do trust to read it for you, and rely on the security of the code. And that's made Tor attractive to security researchers studying anonymity, because this is a model they can work with, they can tweak, they can test it against their theories about the strength of anonymity and weaknesses in possible anonymity networks. And can help the project to improve. Every published paper that describes a potential attack on Tor helps Tor because it helps us to know, or it helps those developing Tor to focus attention on fixing those problems, on helping users to understand where the strengths and weaknesses of current anonymity technology are. And so Tor has a bibliography of anonymity research, and through that work has garnered more volunteers, more support, and worked with Electronic Frontier Foundation for a while as it was sort of getting started in the move to a nonprofit entity, and then formed its own nonprofit so that Tor could sort of take control of its development and develop a real strategic focus about where we want the project to go, how we want to get there, and seek out the funders to whom these goals are important. So Tor recently published a three-year roadmap describing some of the important pieces that the project is focusing on, greater robustness in the network, greater ease of use for censorship avoidance by those in countries or locations where unfettered access to the internet is blocked, and various feature additions to help users make more effective use of the network.
It's, as I mentioned in my introduction, Wendy, the users of Tor are quite varied. And, of course, again, an organization that has its roots in both the FF and the military, you would expect to have that divergence. In your estimation, and given your background, because you also were the founder of Chilling Effects, the organization that focuses the impact of cease and desist letters and other activities on speech through the use of intellectual property rights in particular, what would you say is the most surprising or the most fantastic use of Tor that you're aware of? In other words, who would be the most surprising user, in your view, of Tor?
Well, probably one I haven't yet heard of, because, of course, the great property of an anonymity system is even we don't know all of the users,
of course.
Or even most of the users, and most of their uses. But
at least of what you've heard
going
of.
Going to security conferences, I hear about researchers who use Tor to research botnets and malicious sites, to disperse the traffic that they're sending in those investigations. Going to a blogger conference in China, I saw Tor installed on all of the machines that bloggers were using there to get their commentary out beyond the Chinese firewall and to gain access to that information and share it more freely than they'd be able to do on the Chinese version of the internet, and bloggers who, or commenters to blogs who want to say something without fear of frivolous lawsuits, can use Tor so that rather than just clicking the "I want to be anonymous" box on a blog that may not display your name but still records the IP address in various web server logs and histories, if you use Tor to connect to that site, the only IP address you're leaving is a Tor exit node, which doesn't have any connection to you. And so each time I see another frivolous lawsuit being brought against a blogger or commenter on blogs, even though the courts are developing relatively good tests for protecting people against information disclosure, they're saying it's not enough just to claim you've been annoyed by a comment in order to get the commenter's name. You actually have to show that you have suffered an actionable harm to your reputation, a real defamation claim. But to get a court to make that determination, someone who has to call a lawyer, move to quash a subpoena, contact their ISP, ask that the information not be turned over, if they've left that trail, whereas if they've used the technology to help them protect anonymity, they can avoid some of those frivolous claims from the start.
Andrew, Wendy's comment, I think, raises an, perhaps an obvious question, and one that I know that you've that Tor has dealt with recently, which is how do users know that Tor itself isn't watching the information that you're trying to protect? I mean, I accept the fact that Tor doesn't monitor it, and certainly all the information and statements that Tor's made would indicate that it doesn't, and of course, ultimately, it would defeat the purpose of Tor if Tor were monitoring. But how does a user of Tor know that it, that isn't happening?
So, yes, I've had this question. This question actually came up when I was working with victims of domestic violence, in that the survivors wanted to help current victims, you know, and hear the things you need to do, and then they are very aware of being watched. They are very wary of what trails they leave and, you know, what information they leave where. And my answer is the same as, you know, the, for anybody, whether you're an activist, whether you're just a normal person, whether you're a victim of domestic violence or whatever, is you don't have to. Even if we were recording everything, you know, the logistics of doing that and recording that as a nonprofit without vastly some of the money than we have is nearly impossible. The tests are go online, leave bits of data, see if someone, you know, see if things can be correlated back. You don't have to trust the software we provide. You can get the source code straight from the source code repository and build your own. And if you can't do it, you can probably find someone who can. I know many organizations that don't actually use our packages, even though they're personally signed by Roger and I and others. So you can go look up and see, you know, do I trust this person or not? You can take the source code, you can take the instructions we provide, and say, here's how to build packages. I'm always impressed when someone, you know, like my mother or grandmother or something like that, who will walk through a set of instructions just to verify that, you know, what's there is there, and what we said is true. When you look at the architecture and design of Tor, there are no real choke points. The only issue would be the directory authorities, where trying to get seven different people and organizations to agree on what we're going to do and how we're going to, you know, basically surveil these users is difficult in practice, and even then, you can just say, I don't trust this directory authority. You can put it in your configuration file saying, you know, this organization, this Tor thing, I don't trust them. And there's others you can talk to prove or disprove that. Again, like Wendy said, everything is open sourced. Everything is transparent. We publish what we're going to do. We publish all the changes to our code. We publish, you know, as a nonprofit, by definition, we have to publish, here's where our funding comes from, here's where, here's what we do with our funds. And, you know, that makes us more transparent than most private sector businesses and even, you know, just other nonprofits.
We're talking with Andrew Luman.
That's the best I can give, is that if after all this you still don't trust us,
and
don't use our software.
Yeah, I think it's the I think it is the classic answer to people that say that they're offended by what they see on the internet or what they see on television, here on the radio. Well, you can always turn it off. We're talking to Andrew Luman and Wendy Seltzer of the Tor Project. Wendy, you know, you mentioned some really startling and I think illustrative examples of the use of Tor, and I'm curious to know. I mean, is the use of Tor itself a flag? I mean, let's assume for the moment that communications that would otherwise be suspicious to a nosy government or a government seeking to shut down communication, is it conceivable that using Tor, either by recognizing that the software has been downloaded or by identifying or being able to trace a certain amount of relay information could itself be a red flag? Are you aware of that issue coming up, or is there a technical reason why that wouldn't be the case?
I'm not aware of any place where someone has identified that as a problem, where somebody has reported persecution based on the mere use of Tor. Where governments are heavily involved in surveillance of their users, their internet users' communications, we do take steps to help people make their use of Tor look as similar to other internet traffic as is possible, so that it's harder to block that traffic. We certainly say on the Tor website, we can't know all of the risks that your communications face. It's always up to the individual to take precautions. But for somebody who has determined that he does want to be a whistleblower and recognizes that while that's risky, it's a risk he's willing to take, it's good to have some software that enables someone to take that risk, that enables him to post the document exposing corporate wrongdoing, to share with WikiLeaks the treaty under secret consideration, to help get information out to the world.
You raise an interesting point, Wendy, which I think is worth exploring in the remaining 10 or so minutes that we have, and I have a few more questions here. But, you know, certainly you mention uses of Tor that have the air of nobility and good behind them, the idea of bloggers attempting to speak in a country that locks down communication. But there have been reported instances of uses of Tor in ways that no one would agree are good, and obviously the most pernicious, at least that I've read that's been reported, is the use of Tor by child pornographers and people seeking to distribute child pornography. You know, I think your answer suggests, and certainly what you mentioned about the website would suggest, that Tor seeks to insulate itself, and perhaps properly so, from those illegal uses. But how does Tor deal with those definitely not only illegal but morally reprehensible uses of the technology?
Well, clearly we don't condone, support, cooperate with any illegal use of the technology. We don't give assistance to users who are trying to do unlawful things with the software. And we make very clear that we don't support those uses. But part of the design of the technology is that Tor cannot control what people do with the software. In order that we can't be subverted by a malicious actor, that we can't be told by an evil government to put a backdoor into the software is designed against control. And so one consequence would very much like to help rid the net of child pornography, for example, we can't make the software a tool against that.
So I can add to that.
Yes, please.
Yes, jerks can use Tor. You know, criminals have every incentive to hide everything they do online so they can continue to profit from their activities. Criminals existed before Tor existed. Criminals will continue to exist. They will, you know, choose Tor. They write bots. They take over computers. If you're already willing to break the law, you know, you're probably equally as anonymous as if you hack into a million PCs and turn them into your spam botnet as if you use Tor. In fact, it's probably better to do it the spam botnet way because Tor doesn't allow email, you know, like spam through its just by default, by default configuration. The normal, typical internet user doesn't even think about these topics. They don't think about, you know, I'm going to go online, what information am I giving up? A criminal knows very well the price they pay if they get caught. So they're willing to break any laws and do anything to make sure they don't get caught. And if, you know, a number of innocent people get damaged in the way, so what? You know, it's not their concern. I've worked, did talk to law enforcement agents who, yes, Tor can be a double-edged sword. However, you know, old-fashioned, solid police work will most likely catch anybody over time. Many of the child porn rings, just like you'd infiltrate, you know, gangs and stuff in the early 1930s, the same way you do it now. You know, you become a trusted member. It doesn't matter if they use Tor, if they use, you know, BitTorrent or any other peer-to-peer technology. You know, if they use satellite phones or whatever, you become a trusted member. Law enforcement gets involved. Some of the ways they do this is through Tor. You know, if you're an FBI agent trying to infiltrate some sort of criminal ring, you probably don't want to be coming from FBI.gov. You probably don't want to be coming from an IP address or a network, you know, that comes out of your headquarters in whatever state you're in. Criminals already know these IPs, they already know who you are. You come through Tor, you're just like anybody else. The strength of Tor is that anonymity loves company. The more Tor looks like the general internet, the easier it is to hide within that signal. And, I mean, again, that's true for law enforcement and criminals. But criminals over time will make mistakes. They will create trust relationships. And, you know, the old-fashioned police work that's worked for thousands of years will continue to work. Human nature hasn't changed. The technologies they use do. So, you know, while we can't say, we won't, you know, filter content, we won't, because it makes us liable under, you know, U.S. law, and when you can go into that more, but, you know, we provide a connection to the internet that's anonymized, and that's all we provide. We don't purport to do anything beyond that.
We're talking with Andrew Lumen and Wendy Seltzer of the Tor Project. Alas, we only have about 5 minutes left in our discussion here, and usually this is the time of the show where I start asking questions that are unfair, given the time we have left, and yet I keep doing it. And so, you know, Wendy, I'll ask you this question. I mean, with regard to, and we, because of the time, let's just try to limit ourselves to U.S. law, though we still don't have enough time to get into all the details. But with regard to U.S. law, how does Tor interact with the current laws as related to privacy? In other words, is Tor ultimately acting in harmony with the law? And how do we deal with the idea that code is law, the idea that Larry Lessig made prevalent? How is Tor and laws relating to privacy interrelated?
Well, the unfortunate piece is that we don't have a tremendous amount of law relating to privacy in the U.S., particularly law relating to privacy against non-governmental collectors of information. Most of that is some weak enforcement of the privacy policies that none of us reads linked from the bottom of the web pages that we visit that don't really tell you very much about how the information will be used anyhow. And so if the spirit of the law, though, is that the individual should have some control over his or her dissemination of personally identifying information, then I think Tor is in good harmony with that spirit, that Tor gives people the practical ability to control what the law says they should be able to control.
The follow-up...
If you don't want to...
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
If you don't want to be reliant on a website's privacy policy to protect the information that you've given them, give them less information. Don't tell them enough to link your browsing identity with your real-world persona.
Last question for you before we close with a basic statement of how people can learn more about Tor and get involved. You know, in terms of the press, and I'll leave this to Andrew or Lumen, whoever wants to take it, Andrew or Wendy. Does the press get it? Do you think that in terms of the press that Tor has received, that people understand the technology and support it? Do you have a sense of that?
They're beginning to. With companies offering, so the general answer is people are starting to wake up to what's happening. If you've been a victim of identity theft, you know full well how easy it is to lose your identity and find out, you know, that these other people have done this stuff to the simplest means possible. And, you know, most of it is the old-fashioned, you know, I threw something away. Not, you know, I was surreptitiously sniffing your wireless network at home. But with ISPs looking to increase their revenues and partnering with ad-serving companies and the growing concern, you know, the Olympics in China was a big push for, you know, journalists went to China to report the Olympics, you know, while I'm here, mail reporting some other things, and they find out right away, here are the limits of what you can and can't do. You know, I can't get back to my website to upload my pictures. I can't get back to my editor because I can't email them because my domain's blocked. These are things that sort of put circumvention and limits and your privacy risks in more in the news than in the past.
Andrew and Wendy, for those of people that want to learn more about Tor and about your work, where can they go? Andrew, I guess we'll start with Tor and then more broadly other work that you might be doing. Andrew?
So you can go to our website, which is torproject.org. You can email me. I am Andrew at torproject.org. And, you know, we have a growing body of documentation. There are plenty of other organizations. EFF, Global Voices, are two that come to mind that, you know, we'll talk about. Here are the issues you're going to encounter, and here's why or when you should be concerned about your privacy and anonymity online. And, you know, my job is to be more media friendly and talk to, you know, anyone who is interested in finding out more.
And Wendy, anything to add on that front?
TorProject.org is the place to go to download software, read more about software, read more about getting involved with the project. If you're interested in other questions of legal threats to free expression, then the Chilling Effects Clearinghouse at chillingeffects.org has more of those and more of the responses from law to that question.
Andrew Lumen and Wendy Seltzer of the Tor Project, thank you so much for joining me today and discussing these issues. As always, we can only cover a certain amount of information, even in an hour-long show. But I greatly appreciate you taking the time to join me on Hearsay Culture and to educate our listeners on this fascinating project. I'm a huge supporter and certainly best of luck, and I'll look forward to having you on the show again in the future.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
I'm very excited on Hearsay Culture to continue our discussions of these issues. As you know, listening, we have had a number of guests on that deal with these issues. Most recently, Morel Hildebrandt, who was the editor, one of the editors of the book, A Profile of a European Citizen. We had not only Morel on, but we also have had other guests on, including John Palfrey, that wrote Born Digital, that all deal with these issues of privacy and anonymity to a lesser degree in technology. technology and internet communications. And so a tour is certainly an example of where we can go with the technology and is, in my estimation, a fairly effective tool in dealing with it. I'm looking forward to a number of guests coming up on the show that range from technologists to intellectual property law scholars. Coming up this quarter include Nick Carr, author of The Big Switch. I'm also excited and looking forward to talking to Paul Heald from the University of Georgia, who'll be talking about copyright law issues. Kevin Bankston from the Electronic Frontier Foundation will also be on, and Kevin, incidentally, also has experience dealing with the TOR project. Professors Mark Limley and Dan Burke will be on later in the year discussing their new book on patent law. Jamie Boyle, author of a new book dealing with the public domain, from Duke University, will be on as well. Professor Michael Geist and Ron Diebert, as well as Cory Doctorow, will be on the show separately. I have a Canadian contingent coming on discussing their recent works, as well as intellectual property law issues occurring in Canada. Professor Small, Gary Small, will be on the show discussing his book, iBrain, dealing with issues involving how technology impacts the physiology of the human brain, which is certainly an issue that is becoming more prevalent as we think about how technology impacts the ways that we consume information and really interact with our environment, as well as other guests that I am currently booking. Siva Vaidyanathan will be on later in the year discussing his upcoming book, The Googleization of Everything. And as always, I'm interested in booking new guests, whether they be authors or technologists or people involved in interesting projects. So I always encourage you to send me any comments, suggestions, thoughts, and other ideas at dave@hearsayculture.com. And as always, you can listen to Hearsay Culture a number of ways. The primary way is by tuning into KZSU FM Stanford, Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time. If you're in the Bay Area, you can pick us up at 90.1 FM on the dial, or you can stream live at kzsulive.stanford.edu. You can also get the show through the iTunes podcast page for the Center for Internet and Society by going into iTunes and typing Center for Internet and Society into the search engine. You can pick up the show through the RSS feed at the Center for Internet Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. And lastly, you can pick up the show and all previous shows by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can also find a schedule, upcoming guests, all the previous shows. At this point, there are over 80, as well as occasional ruminations and thoughts on my blog. So I'm looking forward to these guests. I thank you for listening to Hearsay Culture today, and please stay tuned to more diverse programming on KZSU FM Stanford. Have a great day.